ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Economics.
Joining us for a look at business and finance is the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder. Ian, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Evening, Phil. Good to be here.
You take an interesting look at Japan. Now, once upon a time, Japan's post-war economic miracles were the envy of the world, particularly Australia. And by the 1970s and early 1980s, Japan was looked to as the benchmark of economic success, how to grow industry. I mean, this was a country that its manufacturing been devastated, of course, by the Second World War, and it entered the market with cheap goods, as it were. But soon they were the envy of everyone in terms of quality and price and so on. Everyone wanted to learn from Japan. But then Japan went into its long, slow economic decline. But there are signs it may be coming out of it. So what's happening?
Yeah, well, look, it's a really interesting and a cautionary tale, I guess, Phil, because you're right. I mean, Japan was the envy of the world, but it was also, it struck fear into the developed world as well because of, you know, its rapid domination of manufacturing industry, which, you know, was helped along by a couple of things in the aftermath of World War II. One was America's decision that while they'd won the war, they'd better make sure they win the peace. And so they helped Japan, you know, get out of that terrible situation that it had found itself in the aftermath of the war, and particularly after the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And they helped rebuild industry. But it also struck fear into the developed world by the incredible success that it managed to bring about during that period, firstly in terms of manufacturing, and then in terms of its ability to really scour the world and pick up real estate in businesses, mines, all sorts, all manner of things. So there were a lot of people, you know, around the world and in Australia particularly, who were quite concerned about Japan's, you know, looming domination of the global economy. And you're right, it all just came crashing down at the end of 1989.
Why did it? What caused Japan's economic collapse? No, well, not collapse. Well, it wasn't a collapse so much. It was a long and inexorable decline, wasn't it? Why was this? Because, I mean, this was a successful, wealthy country. What happened?
Well, it was essentially down to the speed of its recovery, and a bubble essentially formed. So there was just way too much exuberance within Japan itself and from global investors as well, who poured a lot of money into Japan. Now, you know, during that decade in the 1980s, the Japanese stock market grew sixfold. I mean, just an unbelievable pace of growth during that period. Real estate prices in Japan became the highest in the world and were just mind-bogglingly expensive. Now, there's a great little anecdote that a lot of us like to bring up, and that is the Imperial Palace in the middle of Tokyo, which is, I think, about 3.3 square kilometres. During the height of the property boom, the Japanese property boom, that little piece of land was worth more than the entire state of California in America. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a bit of an idea of just how ridiculous the boom became. And of course, what happened in late 1989? Well, global stock markets had collapsed in 87, and a lot of governments and central banks around the world had pumped money into the global economy to try and keep things afloat, sparked a really strong bout of inflation, and they hit the brakes. They they put interest rates up quite dramatically in the early 90s, and that started to bring global asset prices down. It caused the collapse of quite a lot of entrepreneurial companies, and, you know, we saw them all here. There was Bond Corporation, there was Christopher Scase's group, there was all of those high-flying entrepreneurs all came crashing down, and a lot of those groups had forged links with Japanese business people and financiers as well. And so as global asset prices came down, Japanese banks started to feel the pain. Japanese investors started to feel the pain because they'd really put a lot of money around the world into all sorts of different businesses. And as those businesses devalued, it finally hit the banking system. And there was the collapse of a very large bank called the Long-Term Bank of Japan. And when that collapsed, that really put the entire economy under the skids.
Yes, that's right. I mean, many have pointed to the reasons why Japan could not get out of its problems sooner, because it's only very recently that the Japanese stock market's actually begun to recover, or the economy's began to recover. And this long economic winter, they say, was due in large part to Japanese demographics, that is, the ageing of Japan's population, the fact that Japan doesn't have any immigration, and so on. How do you rate that?
It's probably pretty accurate. And, you know, for a long time, you know, until fairly recently, really, I guess a lot of economists and analysts have looked at Japan as an economic outlier. You know, it had this enormous growth at a period during a period when everybody else was growing, but not to that kind of extent. Then it just went through. It's gone through three decades of flirting with recessions on and off. And, you know, when the rest of the world has done pretty well, really. And now it's starting to come back on at a time when we're all feeling the pain because we've gone through all these interest rate hikes. Japan hasn't. You know, you talk about the demographics. Well, the demographics seem to be really at odds with what was going on in the rest of the developed world. You know, the graying of the population, the shrinking population and shrinking workforce. There was a real concern about that. But if you look around the developed world now, that is something that's actually starting to happen elsewhere in the developed world. China is actually going through the same problems now that Japan first encountered in the early 90s. So rather than being an economic outlier, it may well be the complete trendsetter. It might be, you know, 20 years ahead of the rest of us. So it's difficult to say, but, you know, the demographics certainly have played a large part in it. And, you know, another thing, while we've been all been grappling with this cost of living crisis, well, Japan has been grappling with a deflation crisis for the past 30 years. There's no housing crisis in Japan. There's no problem with buying houses. In fact, just on the weekend, I was talking to a friend of mine from Japan who said you can buy a pretty decent house in Tokyo on the in the outer suburbs, four bedrooms for about $600,000. So, you know, way below what you'd pay here. So the housing crisis is not in Japan. The cost of living crisis isn't there. They do have a shrinking workforce, though. But to some extent, that is actually starting to help things along because the shrinking workforce has meant that for the first time in decades, businesses in Japan have had to actually increase wages, real wages, to try and keep that workforce going, and because there's more competition for workers, and so that is now starting to lift economic growth throughout the country.
Explain Japanese interest rates, can you? This has long puzzled me. Two weeks ago, the Japanese Central Bank raised interest rates for the first time since, 2007. Japan's official interest rate now sits at the, what you describe as princely rate of 0%. But for a long time, it had negative interest rates. If you wanted to keep money in the bank, you had to pay the bank, pretty much.
Yeah, and look, again, Japan has been the complete trendsetter in all of this. Now, we've all heard of quantitative easing because America, you know, embarked upon it in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, as did Europe. And so the rest of the world caught on about 15 years after Japan first embarked down this this road. And when the pandemic hit, everyone got involved in quantitative easing, even Australia. And just look, as a quick recap or a bit of a lesson, what is quantitative easing? It's essentially money printing, but they, instead of just printing the money and pumping it out into the economy, the government issues debt. The central bank buys that debt and holds it as an asset. And when they buy the debt, they pump the money out into the economy. So it's a moot point, I guess, but it's money printing, but a slightly altered form of money printing. Now, like Japan pioneered this in the mid to late 90s. Everyone thought it was just absolute madness that you'd be doing this, but now we're all on board with it. And so that is, again, they've become, you know, not the outlier, but the trendsetter in how to cope with this. Now, as a result of that, they've kept interest rates through that that money printing process, they've kept interest rates at rock bottom levels all the way through their recession. They've tried to get inflation happening without too much luck, but just in the past 12 months or so, they've managed to break that hoodoo, and they've managed to get inflation back up towards 2%. So, you know, big round of applause there. Inflation at 2%, we're all complaining about inflation, you know, at 7% to 10% in the developed world not so long ago.
Yes, all that easing, though, of course, resulted, as you say, in the central bank buying up a whole lot of government debt. Japan has an extraordinary pile of debt. Their debt ratio is at something like 255% of GDP. Australia sits at just 36.5% of GDP. I mean, what is it, Japan? This is something that people often think about America, too. What is Japan going to do about that debt?
Well, that is going to be – that's the real question here, because they have far more debt than anyone else. So that's gross debt that doesn't take into account the financial assets they hold. But it's a pretty good measure. You might recall when Greece was going through that crisis in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, and they had debt of around about 150%. Well, here's Japan with 255%. And as you've said, you know, we all throw our arms up in, you know, just anger, and you know, at Canberra that they've managed to rack up 35%. So it is, you know, way out there as the front runner when it comes to debt. A couple of interesting points here, though. A lot of the money, a lot of the debt is actually raised internally from Japanese households and investors, because Japan, because it has it's an aging population, they don't spend a lot of money, so consumption isn't high, and they save a lot. So a lot of that money has actually been raised internally. A lot of it, of course, has been generated by the by the central bank. But how they cope with this is going to be the lesson that we're all going to learn down the track. One of the restrictions they have, though, is because they have so much debt, they can't raise interest rates very high.
I know, because they raise interest rates, they'll suddenly cripple themselves.
That's right. So, you know, how do you settle all that debt if you're raising interest rates? Well, how do you pay the interest on that debt if you raise interest rates? One of the ways the Reserve Bank of Australia, for instance, is underwater on its quantitative easing program because interest rates went much higher than they issued the debt at during the pandemic. And so what they're going to do is they're just going to hang on to the debt and redeem it once the bonds, you know, are up for, you know, repayment rather than refinance them. And that's going to be the tricky part for Japan. So for the next, I don't know how many years, maybe decade or more, they're going to have to really keep interest rates under control, and they're going to have to really manage that situation quite carefully. Mm. But, you know, as I say, they've gone from being the economic outlier to, I guess, more of the frontier, the not just the trendsetter, but the pioneer in a lot of these programs.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, maybe they are smarter because, I mean, despite the problems, the Japanese people are they can buy a house. There's no cost of housing crisis, as you've said. There's no cost of living crisis. Prices are relatively low, and everyone's got a job, and wages are actually starting to lift as well. So you might argue, what's not to like here?
Well, not only that, per capita GDP is also growing. And, you know, what we've done in Australia, you know, for decades, is to really ramp up the size of our population, really for the past 20 years or more, and 25 years really, and we've done that to keep the economy growing. More people in the economy means the economy is bigger, and so we've kept the economy growing through fairly strong gains in population and immigration. But what that's had a negative effect too, because while our economy as a whole has grown, individually, we're kind of worse off, and particularly in the past year and a half or so, we've had four quarters where what's known as per capita GDP, that's our individual GDP, not the nation. You divide the national GDP by the number of people, and you find out that we're individually going backwards. Well, the opposite is happening in Japan. Their GDP hasn't grown much at all, but individually, they're all better off because the population is shrinking. So it's a really fascinating look at an alternative, really. China is in the early stages of going through what Japan has gone through in the past 30 years. It's got a shrinking population. It's enduring a meltdown in its stock market and in its property markets at the moment. So very, very similar kind of tale, but, it, you know, 20, 30 years behind the time for Japan.
Mm. Very, very interesting tale, I must be said. Ian, terrific to talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.